Okay, hi, Ms. Stove, and we're perilous over lust, and we're here for another call. Thank God, doing okay, one day at a time. I had a topic I wanted to talk about that was pretty religious oriented, actually. I was going to go through the brachas that we say in the morning, from this addict's perspective, and some parts of the davening, and reflect very, specifically on specific things that we say and what they mean to me as a recovering person. That's what I wanted to focus on. Somebody on the pre-recording part of the call, we usually don't start recording until 10 after. Someone on the pre-recording part of the call asked about, he shared, rather, about how he has some resentments against God, some resentments on God, or about a slow on God, whatever word you want to use. Doesn't matter to me. And that's a big problem for him, because if he has resentments on God, then he's left without a power greater than himself that restores him to sanity, basically. He's left without a power. What do we mean when we say a power greater than ourselves? We came to believe in step two. We came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Why doesn't it say, as many people on Guard Your Eyes interpret it, and they still do, that a power greater than ourselves can restore us to sobriety, can get us sober, They kind of look at step two as, I can't stop drinking, God can't stop me from drinking, let him, that kind of thing. Which I think is a big mistake. I think it kind of narrows God down into what makes God special. God is the one that can stop me from drinking, One second, hang on. I'm not sure. Is this thing still being recorded? Yeah, I guess so. I accidentally hit a button. I'm sorry, on my phone. So then these folks basically shrink the entire program down into not drinking. and therefore they shrink God down into the God that keeps me sober, and that's it. Like, that's all he really does for me. That's his claim to fame. That's what makes him special, That's where we see how great he is, that he keeps me from drinking. That's a bizarre thing to say, in my opinion, but if that's how they want to say it, What they need to do then is they basically need to expand the idea of drinking and not drinking and sobriety and not sobriety into a very, very broad, scope. And kind of interpret it in a very loose fashion. Okay. But anyhow, as like that's like the icker issue in their life. And, now I've never met any recovering people who have many years of sobriety or even 1 year of sobriety who are constantly thinking about drinking or not drinking. That's to me, that's pretty strange. There's a little background noise in the background, if you don't mind. Just kind of or fixing your phone maybe or whatever. I haven't met people who are in sobriety, in any fellowship really, that I've, met people in, who have been, every day saying, well, today I might drink, or today I might gamble, or today I might act out sexually. And, God is here to help me do that. Yeah. Okay. Once they'll say that, and then they'll go to sleep at night and they'll have a gratitude for that. Except going through the day with that awareness seems a little bit strange. It kind of truncates the program. It truncates God. It truncates my existence into I'm a drinking man and I'm not drinking now. I'm a drinking man and I'm not drinking now. I'm drinking. It's like, excuse me, that's not recovery. Recovery is about, like they say, our drinking was a symptom of our disease. It's not our disease itself. It's a symptom of our disease. In other words, Sobriety is our problem in life. The challenge of our lives is sobriety, not drinking, you know, not acting out sexually, not taiva. That's not the challenge of our life. The challenge of our life is living, engaging in life, being engaged in life. That's our challenge. When we are engaged in life with no drug to distract us from it and to save us from the stresses of it and the fears of it and the pride that we have that makes life uncomfortable, because life and our pride don't usually mix very well, if we're really engaging in life, you know, walking around with an opinion that everybody else is wrong and I'm always right will doom me to lots and lots of conflict. So internal and external. So life doesn't really work. So pride, our character defects, make life really unlivable. Fear, self-centered fear. If it's not really a healthy kind of fear, if it's an unhealthy degree of fear, and it's, you know, then it's going to interfere in daily life. People, shrinks are dealing with this all over the world, you know. Phobias, not phobias, but fears about all kinds of stuff that are, you know, when a person's living in fear, a person gets very selfish, gets very self-centered. Fear is a tremendously powerful emotion that shrinks a person into cottonness, and, you know, so a terrible, terrible thing when it's not used in a healthy way. Yitzchak Avinu obviously learned how to use fear in a very healthy way. He became Pachad Yitzchak, was how he identified Hashem. So it was how Abraham identified Hashem. I mean, Yaakov identified Hashem that way, that he was the pachad of his father. So he saw that clearly. So, you know, fear obviously is not unhealthy. It's just when it's a character defect, it's unhealthy. So, all right, these things make living life, the real life, not philosophy, not philosophically living life, being. No, it's living life. These character defects make living life itself impossible to do comfortably. So the alcoholic will have to turn to drinking. The gambler will have to turn to gambling eventually. And since we have a disease, we do have a true disease called alcoholism or whatever, you know, sexaholism, whatever it is, we are powerless over alcohol. We're powerless over sex and lust. Since we have that problem, we won't be able to use this drug properly to kind of just take a little bit of the pressure off like normal people can. No, it's not going to work that way. It's going to take over our lives. I'm just as powerless over lust as I was before I came into program. You know, a lot of guys come on Guard Your Eyes not realizing that whenever they post, I'm trying to control this problem, I'm trying to get control of this problem, you know, and they look at Kovesh as Yitzro as the semel for that. Yeah, control it. Kovesh means to capture it. And now you're in control. And they see the Sfarim say, oh, the thing with the Yitzhara isn't to kill it. It's to have control over your type and blah, 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 blah. Okay, so fantasies they have, you know, to be in control of it. That's what they're saying. They don't, often we don't hear what we are ourselves saying. You know, like Terach, you know, Abraham said to him, hey, Hashmeel is nefa mashat amot to be picha, you know, or mash picha another. So we don't hear what we're saying. What these guys are saying is exactly that. They want to control it. They don't want to get rid of acting out. They don't want to get rid of taivas and lusts and things like that. They want to be able, even now, while they're going crazy with the computers for 4 hours and then they walk out with their payas aroi, and their tithis aroi, and their frivolous, even while they're doing all these things, even while this is their reality, that they're hypocritical liars and fakers, and that they go kiseder like this for years, over and over and over, even though they see that they have a terrible problem called faking, not called masturbating and sinning. Faking, that's the real problem. They see it's happening unabated, and they're suffering terribly, so that's the excuse why it's okay, because, well, I'm not Chas v'Shalom, I'm not a Russia, I'm not happy about it. I feel terrible about it, and, you know, I'm working on it, have some rachmanis, you know. So, you know, they don't see, you know, that people come to Guard Your Eyes very often not understanding, they're very well-intentioned, but they're not understanding that their ikkar problem isn't taiva, desire, you know, sinning, sex behavior. That's not their problem. The problem is, I mean, and they come on, therefore, saying, I want to control this. I want to get control over this problem. They're trying to keep hold of their lust and everything around it. And just wait until they're in bed with their wives when they're married, and then they'll be able to go crazy, you know, and use it and enjoy it. Because isn't everything Hashem made for a good purpose, blah, 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 blah. They, you know, they don't, this philosophy gets in the way. It's all about me, 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 and what I want, and that's all there really is. And they don't understand that, and they bring chazals, and it's a lot of, this tremendous confusion. We don't understand that erstens, abstinence. Alcoholics learn. Erstens is abstinence. Number
what is
one,
abstinence? What did you say?
Abstinence.
Now, what was the word before that?
Erstens. It's Yiddish.
Oh.
Erstens means first.
Oh, first.
First thing,
oh,
first. Yeah. The first requirement for an alcoholic is abstinence. There's no question about that. An alcoholic cannot drink alcohol. Now, for those people who hate alcohol, and there are many who hate Alcoholics Anonymous and the whole philosophy, they believe that there is a kind way to drink, and the whole point of recovery for them is to learn how to drink appropriately. And that's their sign, that's their measure of whether they're succeeding at this, if they can drink appropriately. You know, this is not the way of the 12 steps programs all over the world. The way of the 12 steps programs all over the world is humility before God, which starts with abstinence. People who come to Guard Your Eyes and they hear about abstinence, first of all, they faint. Forget about being a Jew and it's halacha, you have to have sex with your wife. It's a mitzvah. What are you talking about? Are you Catholic that you say it's evil and this and that? Well, you know, that craziness comes into the mind for also, but there's, We're who's interested in being sexually abstinent? I mean, who among us is interested? Oh, no problem. Just don't have sex anymore the rest of your life. Not with your hand, not with your wife, not with anybody. You know, who's interested in something like that? You know, and there is no sex fellowship that has that as their bottom line, you know, definition of recovery that I'm aware of. Instead, it's abstinence from lust, or it's abstinence from different things, you know, different fellowships. I can't speak for other fellowships, but lust would be sexually taking sexual behavior that's self-focused. No sex with myself, you know, or anyone other than my wife is a great place, or husband, you know, if you're a lady, is a great place to kind of just make a simple break. Abstinence from any sex with anyone other than my wife, and masturbation is sex with yourself, obviously. So no sex with yourself. And that would be abstinence in a simple way from the troubling behaviors. And that's a great start for recovery. That's the basic sobriety definition of certain sex recovery fellowships, and that's a great place to start. And the point of it isn't to get control over my yetzer hara. I'm just as powerless over lust as I was when I came into the fellowship, when I came into recovery, perhaps even more powerless. I'm not trying to gain power over lust. And an alcoholic is not trying to gain power over alcohol. I understand a lot of people, most people, maybe all people, come to Guard Your Eyes thinking power over alcohol means that they don't have to drink. And power over lust means that I don't have to act out sexually. I don't have to act out my lust. You know, I don't have to masturbate. I don't have to follow a woman down the street, you know, and fantasize about her, or in the supermarket, et cetera. You know, I don't have to do that. And that would be power over lust. But that's, you know, the basic definitions are coming from a sick place there. You know, the basic definition is, for those people, mistakenly, I believe, is powerless means that I'm powerless to resist the temptation. And that's not what powerless ever means. The ikkar of powerless in Alcoholics Anonymous for alcohol means that I'm powerless to control and enjoy it. I can't drink like a gentleman. There's something wrong with me that I can't enjoy something that normal people can enjoy. And it's the same thing over here. Exactly. I can't enjoy lust fantasies, sex behaviors that are self, you know, focused, which normal people can do sometimes. I can't successfully do that. When I do that, it makes me, you know, when I start doing that, even in a small degree, it's like having a little, an alcoholic, just having a little sip of alcohol Why do they have their sobriety definition? Why don't they, you know, if Alcoholics Anonymous were a Jewish program, you'd have 75 different shitas in what the shita of alcohol is that you have to drink to be over on the sobriety definition. You know, that would be the problem if Alcoholics Anonymous were Chas v'Shalom, a Torah-based or a Jewish organization, a Jewish fellowship. The first thing that would come up within the first year, for sure, there would be tremendous arguments, and then there would have to be a presidium where we decide, and we would agree on a certain shear. That's the shear that's, you know, Milo Ligmov, then there would be the Rover Vias, then there would be the people who say it's the same, then there would be people who, you know, faceness this much, that much, you know. And then, you know, you'd have the crazy Achametz Arizal crowd that would be saying it's even a Mashahu, you know what I mean? You know, and then it would be, you know, Machloksim, and what's the shear and how much is, no, Alcoholics Anonymous has no shear. You know, you drink alcohol, you know, you have to be abstinent from alcohol, you know. So why? Because we can't drink like a gentleman. It's another pshat. I can't drink a cup of wine. You know, I can't drink a whole glass of wine like a gentleman. I can't drink like a gentleman. You know, I'm not normal. And the Fachnukta crowd that says, what do you mean? Can't lust like you're normal. It's usur to lust. It's usur. What do you mean? It's usur. Your goal has to be keeping halacha. Let me ask you, how good has that been going for you? Isn't that why you're here? Isn't your hyper-focus on keeping halacha? Isn't that why you've been masturbating your brains out for all these years? And people hang up angrily when they hear that because they know it's the truth. The truth. The reason that you've been, and Hilchas Yichud is fantastic. Hilchas Tzniyah is fantastic. Hilchas Nida, Harchakas, etc., fantastic. They are so powerful and such wonderful things. Even for me, a sexaholic, to go look at that and say, "That's, I see the beauty and wisdom in it. It's fantastic stuff. Absolutely fantastic stuff. However, when I'm ill, I misinterpret all those things, and they feed my disease like nothing else can. They feed my disease tremendously. You know what I'm saying? A guy, you know, has Hilchas Yichud on his mind. He sees a woman, and what does Hilchas Yichud teach him? That if he's alone with a woman, she'll have sex with him. That he's nefshad, she's nefshad. You know, a guy is nefshad on raping him. This, that, and it's all kinds of crazy stuff goes through his mind that sexualizes every situation becomes sexualized if you understand those halachas wrongly and you apply them wrongly in your heart. Chazal didn't create Hilchas Yichud in order to sexualize a situation. And the guys who say, what do you mean, sexualize it? This reality is you might have sex. And then, you know, you might rape each other. She might rape you. You might rape her. You don't understand. Those guys are sexualizing the situation, you know? You know, when Reb Chaim Kanievsky is alone with a lady, it's not because, and, you know, and then he walks out of the room or he opens the door or chmesnish, whatever. It's not because he's thinking, I might have sex with her. That's not the issue. The issue is he's trying to keep Hilchas Yichud properly because he loves the Ribbono Shel Olam and he wants to keep his halachos and he trusts Chazal. What's their reason? I should be thinking about these things? I'll sexualize the situation. And then to get into an argument about, well, Forth, what was their reason then? That comes out of the mouth of a man who is desperate to sexualize every situation. And he looks at halacha desperately to sexualize everything. And he's the one who goes and looks at women and says, wait a minute, it's above her knee, it's below her knee, she's wearing socks, she's wearing sheer pantyhose, she's wearing opaque pantyhose. It's, what is it? You know, this sheitel is not sneezdika sheitel, it's a joke. Look at the color, it's flaming red with the curves and the things and here and this. And he's all... The ones that are the most openly fachnyokt and crazy yelling about these things, internet, those are the guys with the biggest internet problems. Not every single time, but I guarantee you that there's a good percentage. You know that whenever you have another Republican senator who is caught in the bathroom making footsie signs with some police officer in a sting operation in the bathroom for anonymous, you know, stuff, it's always another Republican conservative senator who's been outspokenly against gay people, you know, and he's been having sex with men all the time in bathrooms, you know, public bathrooms here and there, and meeting them in the car. This is the way it always happens. It's the most outspokenly against person. Kol ha-poiso, the mumo poiso, is how the Gemara puts it, you know. It's the ultimate answer to kshod atzmacha, and then kshod acherim. No, kshod acherim, so I don't have to kshod myself. Fix other people so I don't have to fix myself. You know, that's human nature in general, but in specific when it comes to these problems. This is part of the sickness. And it's not necessarily that these people are addicts. This is just a character flaw, you know. Addiction is a different matter, you know. I'm just talking about, you know, and of course addicts will have these character flaws as well, as I know for myself. We have character flaws. We're not, you know, when a person says he's an addict, he's not saying I'm an addict, and therefore that's my only problem. He's really saying, like I said before, I'm an addict because I have so many other problems that I turn to my drug because I can't stand living. Sobriety is my problem. You know, and I'm trying to avoid sobriety. And that's why guys come on Guard Your Eyes. For those of the people on Guard Your Eyes, Wall of Honor, et cetera, who are addicts, when they come on and they can only get a certain number of days and they can't go, and the shot is that they can't stand but so much sobriety. You know, a certain amount of sobriety happens, and then life becomes unbearable. Not because they're holding back, their penis is about to explode, they're feeling horrible pains of this and that, and oh, how long do you expect me to go without it? That's not the issue. The issue is what's happening in your life. Come on, let's be honest here, please. Be honest. Be honest for a change, you know? Now, if the person is going through life thinking, I should be having sex all the time, if that's their philosophy, I should be having sex all the time. So now, of course, a certain number of days goes by, and of course, he can't, like the many, many Hasidic guys, they say, oi, Dov, I can't hold myself, you know? And it's like, of course, you can't hold yourself. You can't hold yourself because you're walking around thinking, I should be having sex today. Oh, today went, I didn't have sex. Nope. I should be having sex tomorrow then. You know, it's time, so shine its sight, you know. The Gemara says, you know, every day, Tamachochem, I'm not a Tamachochem, so, okay. You know, and it's like, what, you know, I should be having, so he's walking around, this is not an addiction. I'm not describing addiction, I'm describing a character trait of entitlement. If a person, this isn't necessarily proof that the person's an addict. The person's walking around assuming he should be having sex every day. At least once or twice with his wife. It's a mitzvah. He should be having sex every day. So if he's walking around with that, so then every day that goes by is going to be increasing his torture. I'm not talking about addiction here even. I'm just talking about a character defect that's causing life, real life, which if you're a real person and you're talking about sex with your wife, then she's a real person too. She's not a cow. You know, she's not an object, you know. So, you know, she doesn't want it. She doesn't want it, you know. You're going to have to deal with it, you know. Oh, take her to court. Das Yehudis, this, that, you know. Come on, calm down. There are situations like that, but that's not what we jump to. The first thing we jump to is, what's the matter with me over here? What is the matter with me over here, you know? They talk about Ben Azai, you know, Ben Azai went, friend of Rabbi Akiva there, you know, Ben Azai goes and he never gets married, and the Gemara says, yeah, he got married for a short time, and he didn't get married at all, this and that. Rabbi Akiva went away for 24 years from his wife and didn't have sex for 24 years. He came home to his wife in the middle of the 12 years with 12,000 Talmidim, and he heard her say behind the door, when someone made fun of her, she said, oh, I wish he would learn for another 12 years. You think this 12 years is something I regret? I'm proud of it, you know, for myself and for him. I'm proud of it. And he turned around and he went without coming in for a cup of coffee because he didn't want to break up the beauty of 24 straight years. Maybe for other reasons, I don't know. He turned around and he went back for another 12 years, and he had 24,000 Talmidim when he came home, and he didn't have sex for another 12 years. He went without sex for 24 years, okay? And this is the same Rabbi Akiva who went by the room of his Rebbe when his Rebbe was having sex to learn from his Rebbe how to have sex with his wife. This isn't from a man who was like, oh, sex, please, that's for goyim, you know? This is from a person who knew what sex was, you know? And good sex, what kind of sex? Healthy sex. It was something that meant something to him. And he wasn't trying to figure out for himself, he had it in the circle, he was talking about sex, you know? So this isn't coming from some kind of prude, you know? Rabbi Akiva wasn't the prude. So what's going on over here, you know? Getting back to the point. Obviously, you know, the Gemara doesn't go crazy about Gevalt. How could he go? Wait, okay, I have all this kashas, this kashas, that kashas. But how could he be mavato, the mitzvah of having sex with your wife all the time for 12 years, and then another 12 years, enough, and then not come in for an interruption for at least let's have sex for one night, you know? How could he not do that? The Gemara doesn't talk about that. All the Sfarim don't go crazy about that. They don't pay attention to that fact, that he didn't have sex for 24 years. You know, it's like, you know, guess what? You don't have to. Next, you know, that's obviously how the Gemara sees it. But anyhow, so what are all these Talmidei Chachamim who are old, you know, whose wives died, you know, they're all masturbating at home? Come on. Let's get a little touch of reality here, you know, a little touch of reality. It's not, there's no real entitlement that I need it, and therefore the pressure builds up, but what am I supposed to do? But I'm trying to say life becomes unbearable, and this is just one example. Even the wall of honor, even for non-addicts, it becomes unbearable if I'm walking around with entitlement on my mind. You know, if I'm walking around with entitlement, that's another simple example of how life, sober life, becomes unbearable. And therefore, it's not the acting out that's my problem. I need to stop seeing porn as my problem, sex as my problem. Masturbation, avarice as my problem, tivus as my problem. That's not my problem. My problem is entitlement. I'm an arrogant man who thinks that I should be having sex every day. That's my problem in that kind of a case. Okay? That's the angle to start. That's a starting point. My problem is living without sex. That's my problem. Living without porn. You know, going another day without it is just unbearable to me. In other words, living, life, sobriety is my problem, not acting out. So why? Why is it such a problem for me? Well, because I'm a man, you know. No, it's not because I'm a man. We see what a man is from Rabbi Akiva. It's not because I'm a man, you know. It's because I have entitlement. I have a character flaw that I feel entitled because I'm an arrogant guy who thinks that he's extremely sexy and his wife should be desiring him every day. And because I'm an arrogant guy thinking that things should be going the way I want them to go. And because I'm an arrogant guy expecting, no, sex, let's go, come on, no. You know, and it's like, hello, sex is, it takes two to tango, you know, what's going on with her? Well, she has problems. You have to know my wife. She's not exactly a well woman. You know, okay, well, then get therapy, you know. And if she won't get therapy, get therapy for yourself. Go to a therapist yourself. Get therapy. You know, don't go to a Rav and talk about self-control because you're such a martyr and a tzaddik. You know, that's playing the game again. That's a little dance there, you know, that we all play. I'm a martyr. I'm a martyr. Give up. I'm a martyr. So, yes, there are special situations, but I'm talking for most of us who are out there. Most of us who are out there are in relatively healthy marriages. 90% of the emails that I get are from guys who say, oh, my wife has no idea, we have a healthy marriage, and I'm still doing all this stuff. That's 90% of the folks out there. And then the Bachrim, of course. You know, excuse me. And by the way, Bachrim generally, unless they're walking around with incredible arrogance about how handsome they are, and they might be very handsome, and how, you know, they should be having sex all the time if they were only married, you know, with a woman, and na-na-na-na-na, then they walk around with this awareness, and then, of course, it becomes unbearable for them not to have sex, where, you know, Bachrim generally have an easier time staying sober than married guys. I had to pass Masalo. No, it's quite the opposite. If you're an addict, being a single guy, you can shut the sex thing off. You can just flick the switch a little bit. Being married, there's no guarantee that you can flick any switch at all. You can't turn it off so easily without causing shalom bayis problems. You know, it's not so push it, you know. But when you're a bucher, it's a whole different story, you know. Oh, I got some music in the background now. Help me out here, Chava. So, thank you, dear. Thank you. So the arrogance, this is an arrogance that we have that, you know, we should be desired and this and that, and I want to be lusted after, and it becomes impossible to flick that switch off. But if you're a bucher, you should be able to flick that switch off. You know, if your wife's a nida, you should be able to flick that switch off. It's generally easier for most married guys who are addicts when their wife is a nida than when she's materis. When she's materis, it becomes a giant sex issue. When she's a nida, it's like, okay, well, I know we're not having sex. It's the opposite of pas v'salo, and it's much more effective than any pas v'salo. You understand what I'm saying? People who think pas v'salo, they hear the good lines. Pas v'salo, they think, well, since he knows he's going to have sex, and then it's okay, life is good. Okay, right now I won't have it. I'll have it tomorrow, so it's okay. That works nicely in the short term, you know, but over the long term, it doesn't work at all. And what works much, much more effectively, really, is, well, sex is off the agenda because she's a nida now, you know. Sex is off the agenda because she hates me now. She just caught me masturbating to a scene of two people having sex on the computer, and she hates the guts now, and she's shocked that I would have lied and tricked her for such a long time. There ain't no way sex is happening now, and usually these guys are kind of dried up for a little while, and we're okay because we can shut that switch off. Somebody has like a background noise, hissing or something. If you can just star 6 your phone, that would help a lot, Father. Thank you very much. So back to the thingy. So ultimately, it's you know, even if you're not an addict, the arrogance is going to get you if you've got arrogance, which we all have some degree of it, obviously. So, you know, look at me here on the call speaking to you like I know everything. You know what I'm saying? Talk about arrogance. So getting back to the original point, okay? Life becomes unlivable, and that's the big problem. And therefore, we walk around as fakes because we try to pretend that we're living life okay, and then we try to fake ourselves that our problem is the Yetzer Hara. We try to pretend that our problem is the Yitzhahara, and we go doing tshuva and guard your eyes and tafsik shvuas and all of honor and all these tools to try to stop acting out as though the acting out is the problem. The acting out isn't the problem. The not acting out is the problem. The problem we have is not acting, is not acting out. Living the life that God has given us, with the parents God has given us, with the wife God has given us, with the children God has given us, with the job God has given us, with the traffic God has given us, in the day that God has given us, living each day, accepting each day in a healthy kind of a way, without a need for a payoff. Well, pay me. You know, if you're going to give me a crappy day like this, God, then pay me, you know, at least pay me for it. You know, that's what's going on inside us. That's a problem. That's a real, real problem, you know. So getting back to something that somebody brought up, having resentment against God, you know. He said that he doesn't have a power greater than himself. So I got off the point a little there because I focused on the definition of sanity, of, you know, having second step. We found a power greater than ourselves that could restore us to sanity. And I'm defining sanity as sanity, not sobriety, just what the word says, sanity, you know, living life without having to drink, living life in such a way that I don't have to drink, being comfortable and at peace peace, at peace and in comfort with myself and with the life that God has given me, which includes myself, the people that I'm associated with, and the stuff that I've got and don't have and have to do and, you know, happens around me and all that. That's how we understand living in a sound sanity, is living in a sound way, you know, living soundly, soundness of mind. In other words, you know, while you live, soundness of mind, this basic definition of sanity, look it up in a dictionary. So how do I live with soundness of mind is that I'm comfortable, basically comfortable with what's going on and what I have to do and the life that God has given me and gives me right now. And, you know, I can face this life and live this life. That's, you know, having found, you know, second step, finding a power greater than ourselves that can restore us to sanity. Why doesn't it say that restores us to sobriety, that stops us from drinking? Because the focus of our lives isn't drinking. Even for the drunks, the focus of the life isn't drinking. The focus of their life is escaping from life, because life is unlivable for me as an addict. By myself, life is unlivable. I need help to accept life. You know, I need help. I will not naturally accept life. Left to my natural proclivities, I will reject life. And instead, I will opt for, you know, drugging out on something. You know? How does a person who is an addict, let's say, like the guy who was calling at the beginning of the call, how does a guy like that have a power greater than himself that can restore him to sanity? How does his life remain livable, acceptable to him, you know, so that he can accept it with both hands and function? How does that happen if he hates God because he's angry that God took this away from him, you know, God forbid, or that from him, or isn't giving him this or didn't give him that or whatever it is? You know, people, God forbid, I mean, people have tsaras, you know. And even if we don't have tsaras, a lot of times when people say to me something like, you know, I have this tremendous resentment against God, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, what ends up is, okay, so what's your resentment about? You know, so, you know, God forbid, I'm expecting them to say something like, you know, whatever, I mean, somebody died, you know, and losses. I mean, I don't even want to say it, like a terrible loss, you know. You know, I mean, there are people who have no children. There are people who have lost, God forbid, no children. There are people who, you know, lose a spouse or get fired from a job or get arrested, you know, for sex reasons and for other reasons that have nothing to do with addiction or sex or anything like that. There are people who get arrested, and there are some that get arrested unfairly. I know if you go to a jail, you talk to everybody there, every single one of them was arrested unfairly. But some of them were. Come on, you know, that's obvious. That's what happens in a real society where you have imperfect police and imperfect judges and imperfect witnesses and whatever. So life isn't quote unquote fair, you know. But then when they tell you what the problem actually is, it's like, usually it's something like, well, not always, but usually it's something like, well, I just can't seem to have peace with the fact that, you know, whatever. And it's like, okay, it's mostly in your head then. Well, yeah, but it's very important to me, you know, and I really resent God for it. You know, it's like, okay, you know, so, you know, and then you have the addicts who say, well, my big resentment is that he made me an addict, you know, and it's like, uh-oh, what do you do? So there's this whole philosophy that I've heard back in the day on Guard Your Eyes of, you can't have a resentment against God because God is God. How can you have resentment against him? It's stupid because he's obviously perfect. Look at the Torah. Look at what the Torah teaches us. So you can't have a resentment against God. But hello, that means, really what that means is, in reality to me, is that you don't treat God like he's a real person, like he's a real entity. You know, how can you have resentment against a philosophical idea? You know, how can you have resentment against a guilt-ridden concept, you know, or allegiance and, you know, and that's it. Well, is he real or is he not? Does he make decisions or does he not? Does he make choice? Does God make choices or does he not? You know, we believe he does, at least from our perspective. The way you understand Malchus, you know, it switches from the perspective above and the perspective below, this farm teaches. So the way we understand it the way we perceive it from our, in our puny way is that we see God making decisions, which of course doesn't make sense from his perspective, because Hashem, ani Hashem lo shanisi, you know what I'm saying? God can't, kaviyachol can't change. How can you change if you're infinite and perfect? So how do you make decisions? You're different before the decision than you are after the decision. You know what I mean? That's what Hashem means. Before, according to the Arizal's count of the Yud Gimel Midas, they start from Kale, but the first two words before that are Hashem, Hashem, which, you know, if you look in the Ramak's pre-Arizal Svarim, they'll count Hashem, Hashem in the Yud Gimel Midas, and they'll say, Hashem, Hashem means basically Hashem is the same before you do an Aver and the same Hashem after you do an Aver. You know, so like there's some perspective where he doesn't change and there is no decision and there is perfect acceptance at all levels, no matter what you do. You know, there's some level of that that's, you know, B'sharshan, you know, okay, but we don't operate B'sharshan. We operate down here in Olam Ha'asiyah. It's a little different than B'sharshan, you know, way back up there and that perfect, you know, region where there's no gevura, where there's no operating gevura, really, you know, and then, okay, we don't operate there. So yeah, from a functional perspective, from our perspective, Hashem makes decisions, and that means that appears like change, you know, Chas v'Shalom, but that's what it appears like. So, you know, but anyway, aside from the philosophical decisions, discussions, getting down to reality, how can you have a resentment against God if he's, you know, come on, the rules say he's perfect. You know what I mean? Well, that's the point. These guys who are saying you can't have resentment against God are basically saying they're pretending like you're up in the shoresh, like you're up in fancy schmancy, you know, up in, you know, Arich Anten floating around somewhere, you know? You know, you're floating up in Kesser somewhere, you know? You're not. You're down here in the Dreyat over here, you know? You're here in the gutter, with God operating in the gutter with you, and the way God functions over here is not, in a way that we can perceive as perfect, and not in a way that we can always perceive as nice. So if you really take God seriously, you better be able to have a resentment against him, because otherwise he's just a concept. And halachas will govern what you're allowed to feel and what you're not allowed to feel about a concept, you know? By the same token, it's usher not to trust God. You realize that? It's not just a mitzvah to trust God. It's usher not to trust him. Because that's essentially emuna. That's avodah zarah, you know? That's, even if you don't serve any avodah zarah, that's atheism. That's it. And this is what the Chafetz Chaim says. Chafetz Chaim says in Shemolim, or I don't know, one of his farim, that you know, in every Avera, there's a little bit of apikorsis. That's what it is, you know? You know, and we live this way. That's how we live, you know? That's how we live. That's why Yom Kippur, which is Mechaper on everything, what's the whole point of Yom Kippur? Is Lefnai V'Lefnim, the moment with the coins, there's the, you know, the connection between, no, awareness of God in the cloud and this, and he reveals himself. That's the Kapara. Connection with God is the kapara. Emuna with God is the kapara. You know, b'cho chosmin. You know, that the whole tikkun ha'olam happens through emuna. You know, and that's because that's what it's all about. Self-erasure. Bittul of myself. You know? Not bittul of myself that I don't exist. I'm not talking about that kind of bittul. I'm talking about, that's like a Buddhist kind of thing. I'm talking about bittul of myself, meaning humility. You know, that I don't understand you, God, and you run the show, and you're right all the time. I just don't understand that. And my emotions tell me that you sure are screwing up. That's what my emotions tell me. That's what my emotions tell me. Whenever I'm angry at God, it's because I feel like he's really screwing up. And that's the truth of what I feel. And he knows that. And instead of going, well, I have to do a tremendous kapara over having such horrible, terrible, apikorsish emotions, that's not the point. The Chofetz Chaim doesn't suggest, you know, well, since in every avera there is a certain avodah zarah going on, a certain bit of apikorsis going on, that should be the entire focus of everything? No. Nobody says that. You do tshuva for the avera. You look at the machshavas and things that lead you to the avera. Open up Rabbeinu Yonah. He doesn't spend the entire shar, you know, over there talking about how to fix your emunah, the whole thing. No, he talks about the avera and what to do with the behaviors and the thoughts that lead to the avera and this and that. You know, that's called normal tshuva, you know, which all addicts hopefully have tried to do before they came to the point, to the understanding that they're addicts, and tshuva ain't going to work because tshuva never helps an addict. But that's beside the point. Yes, there's an emunah problem, but that's because we always have emunah problems because we live in a world where emunah isn't operating in the perfect philosophical way. And the relationship that we have with God, if you have a relationship with God that's real, then you can be angry at him. If you have a relationship with God that's real, then you can be angry at him. Rahman al-Islam, that, you know, you should need to, but, you know. So now what do you do? That's the question. So now what do I do? And that's what this man was humbly asking at the beginning of the call. What do I do now? I'm not going to browbeat myself like some fachnyokta guy about why, how could I have, wait a minute, how is it possible to have anger against the Rabbani Shalom if everything he does is perfect? Wait a second. Who says everything he does is perfect according to you? Oh, well, that's a big problem. Then that's what I should focus on. Well, guess what? Now you're coming into the answer. You know, that is the answer ultimately. There are two little factoids that are operating over here. One is that Hashem is not Superman. You know, Reb Noach Weinberg used to say all that all the time. You know, that Hashem isn't Superman. Some guy came to Reb Noach and he said after a speech Reb Noach gave about how yeshiva is all about coming to know God. Can you imagine that? That yeshiva is all about coming to know God? I don't know. I thought it was coming to know the Masechta. But anyway, so Reb Noach Weinberg, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, used to always say, yeshiva is about, come to yeshiva so you can learn about God. All the time he would say, this is like his whole, and he believed it, and it's true, and I believe it too. And so did his brother, and so did lots of the Jews, and so do many of us. It's coming to know God. So then this guy comes over to him and says, I don't need to go to yeshiva. And Reb Noach said, oh, that's you know, interesting. Why? And the guy says, well, I was riding. This guy's a complete, it looks like a Shagetz, you know. And he says to him, well, I was riding my bike, and I fell off a cliff, and I landed squarely, a big fall, but I landed between two rocks, and it broke my fall. The slipping between the angle of the two rocks was such that I got scraped up, but nothing happened to me after falling, like, you know, I don't know, a big, giant fall that was very dangerous and, I mean, should have killed me, really. And I amazingly walked away with just a couple of scratches, you know. So that was a miracle. That's obvious. And everyone who I show it to, I go to that place, and they say, that's impossible. And I say, no, I fell off of here, and I landed right there between these two rocks. And they go, that can't be. That's impossible. And he goes, well, it happened, and it's a miracle, and I believe in God, so I don't need to go to yeshiva. So Reb Noach would say to him, well, let me ask you a question. Why did God let you fall off the cliff if he's so perfect and so awesome? I mean, if he's that awesome, why did he let you fall off the cliff? It's like, well, that makes sense to you that he went, whoops, oh, I got to fix this, and he nestled you between the rocks? That doesn't really make sense. So he says, no, you're right, it doesn't really make sense. So Reb Noach said to him, well, maybe he was trying to get your attention. Have you ever thought of that? You know? Because you have no connection to God at all except this bike riding incident. That's pretty weird. That's why he created you? You know, come on. You know, maybe he was trying to get your attention. Maybe he wants you to go to a yeshiva. And the whole room burst out laughing because it's the way he said it was always funny. And he's a beautiful man. So, and you know, so God isn't Superman. So then if God isn't Superman trying to solve all of our problems for us, you know, and really we're here for him, so then let me ask you a question. Does that mean that we shouldn't be here for ourselves at all and it's all about him and to heck with you? Well, then why does the whole Tehillim filled with Hashem Roi, Laechsar, Inos, Deshe, Yarbitzeni, Ame Menuchos, Yinahaleni, Nafshi Shaveiv, what's going on over here? Hashem Roi, Hashem is my shepherd. I shall lack nothing. Lo echsar. What's the purpose over here? Is Hashem here for me to be my shepherd and to take good care of me? Or am I here for Hashem and it's not about me at all? Which one is it? You know? So the program straddles both of those very beautifully, you know. I mean, we see that there's a mitzvah to daven for your needs from Hashem and this and that.
By the tzaddikim, they don't do that. By the real, you know, big tzaddikim, they don't generally, you hear these things, if you open up a Tiferes Shmuel, Tiferes Shlomo, you know, from the Radomsker, you'll see it's, generally speaking, like, these big tzaddikim, they're always thinking for the, everything l'man Hashchina, everything for Hashem's expression in the world, you know, Hashchina. You know, that Hashem's covered in the world, and that's all, everything in their own personal life is all for that, and this and that, and that, and that. Like the tzaddik who said, you know, you think, you know, you make a bracha, and I make a bracha, but you make a bracha in order to eat an apple. I eat an apple in order to make a bracha. It's a very different attitude. So, okay, that's for tzaddikim. That's for great people. That's not, you know, but, you know, we can aim that way, but we, you know, we're not going to get there, obviously, you know, in any perfect fashion, but every now and then we might taste it, and that's beautiful. But what's going on? Are we here for him, or is he here for us? You know? So this seems to be both going on. And this tension is what leads to a lot of confusion, but that's what real life is. You know, you get married to a woman. Is she here for you, or are you here for her? Well, there's three things going on. I'm here for her, but I chose her, so that's me. You know? I chose her. That's me. That means I want her. That's about me. That's not about her, you know? So, you know, and then she chose me. So that's about her for herself. She chose me for herself, you know? And then there's the love between us, that we love each other and that we do for each other because we care about each other and we do for each other. Well, will I die for her? Very often, the answer to that question is yes. You know, but right now, will I live for her? Very often, the answer to that question is no. That's much harder to think to face. So then, what's going on over here? You know, there's a third thing, though, which is living for the marriage, where the husband and the wife don't live for themselves, don't live for the spouse, they live for the marriage. They do things for the marriage, for the sake of the marriage. When you get married, for example, and this isn't just in marriage, this has to do with the Midah of Yesod, which means a connection between two partsufin, in other words, two parties, two parties that two full mention, two, you know, two full entities that have kochas of their own that get together in order to fulfill, you know, to accomplish something that neither could have accomplished by themselves. So, you know, there's a yichud there. Whenever you shake hands in a business deal, it's to produce something that the two of you couldn't have done as individuals. That's the midah of yisod. And if you're confused about this, open up Rabbi Daniel Frisch's sefer called on Sfiras HaOmer called Usfartem Lachem, and look at the week of Yesod. You know, look in two places if you like this kind of stuff. Look in Yesod by the first week where he's really marchiv on the whole Indian, and look in, you know, Yesod Shebechesed. You know, read that day and look at what Yesod is about, you know, and then look in the week of Yesod later on, you know, which is next week. So it's about connection between two parties to accomplish something together. That's the ikkar of it. So, and I think I spoke in a different call about why connection between two parties requires, above all things, hagdara and definition of what those two parties are and what those two parties are not, which is geder arayas, geder erva. But anyhow, so if you look in the, so you're trying to accomplish something that the two parties couldn't accomplish by themselves. That's called the marriage. You know, once you have children, and some people call it the children. You know, we're staying together for the children. You know, so. There's this old joke about this couple that got divorced at the age of like 94 or something, and they said, "Why'd you get divorced now? Oh, we've been planning it for years. Well, why'd you wait until you were 94 years old?" He says, "Well, we were waiting for the children to die, you know." So it's the idea over here. I think it's funny. The idea over here is that how did I get onto that? The idea over here is that I'm trying to accomplish something that's greater than myself by joining with this other force, with this other entity, you know, and that's the marriage itself. And there are many times when my wife and I, we do things that we don't like, but we're doing it for the sake of the marriage, you know. Hopefully that doesn't happen more times than it should, but it should happen. There's a third entity here in the room, the marriage. So anyhow, the other thing over here is that, so getting back to the point, am I here for Hashem or is Hashem here for me? Well, we're here together. We're together, and there's a third entity here called our relationship, my relationship with the Rabbonu Shalom, you know, and that's what Tehillim is all about. You know, it's my relationship with the Rabbonu Shalom, how I... You know, there's intrinsic value in having a relationship with God, connecting with God. That connecting itself is a valuable thing. So we express that we nurture it by doing two things, by asking Him for our needs and by doing what He wants us to do. Meaning, on a simple level, without mixing Torah into this, or even with mixing Torah into this, living the life that He's given us, instead of arguing with the life that He's given us. You know, we take the life that He's given us with both hands. We accept it with both hands. That's an avoda in and of itself, and that's what acceptance is. And that's what the whole program's about. The whole program of 12-step recovery is about accepting the life that God's giving us. And the difficulty we have with accepting the life God's given us is called character defects. Defects of character are the blockage to accepting the life that God has given us. And that's that's step 4, 5, 6, 7. Steps 4, 5, 6, 7, and really 8, 9, and 10 also are about our character defects, blocking us from accepting the life that God has given us and living in a sane fashion. So that's really, that's what we need. We need that help. We need help to do that. You know, we need help to accept this life, to live together with God as partners. So how do I deal with resentment against God? You know, well, my understanding of the point of this life is problematic over here. I'm missing something in the second step. I have lost the ability to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity because I forgot that we're in a partnership, me and God, to accomplish something that He understands very well and that I don't. You know, and that's what I need to do if I want to join, you know, be a partner in this life, be a part of this life in a sane, in a sound way, is to look at this life and say, well, what are my opportunities over here? What is God giving me? God's giving me opportunities. What are these opportunities that He's giving me? You know, I don't like this. I don't like that. I don't like that because I've already made up my mind what it is that I'm supposed to be doing and what the point of my life is and what these opportunities that I'm interested in are. I'm not interested in any other opportunities. I'm interested in these opportunities, you know? Well, maybe there are different opportunities than you realize, you know? What is this relationship really about? You know? We say, oh, He has all the power. It's no fair. Because He can choose what I'm going to do and what I'm not going to do, and I can't. Well, that's not really true. Not really true. Look at yourself right now. You're choosing not to live His life and to live a different life. You have that ability. You know, it's just not going to work out very well. You know, the Tehillim says,
I'm so sorry. I don't think it's Tehillim. I think that it's a Mishlei. Tov v'yasher Hashem al ken yorech atoim baderech. That Hashem is good because he, they say, you know, the way that the Shari Tshuva says, and in the very beginning, it says, because Hashem teaches us the way to go, and here I'm teaching you the way to go to do Tshuva. But I understand it very differently, that it means yoreh from Lashon of shooting. Yoreh. Yoreh kechetz. Yoro yi yoreh, or yoro vayam. It doesn't mean to teach down to the ocean, to show into the ocean. It means that he shot them down into the ocean. Yoreh can mean like a, you know, like an arrow. You don't, you know, it's shooting it. Like a yoreh or malkosh, rain that shoots down hard is yoreh. So, Tov Yosher Hashem. Hashem is so good that Yorech Hatoyim. Hatoyim means people who are making a mistake, as Rabbi Yochum Weinberg used to explain. Doesn't mean sinners necessarily. And Yorech Hatoyim Baderech means that he throws forcibly people who are screwed up, people who are making mistakes. He throws them onto the path. We stumble and fall onto the path against our will sometimes, because he's got an agenda for us. He's got a whole plan for us. And, you know, what's his plan for me is the big question for me to ask at the beginning of each day, instead of how am I going to accomplish these goals that I have. That's all nice, but the background to all that, the Iker question is, and guess what? Let's see what his plan for me is today, because I have no clue. I have a lot of assumptions. I have a lot of plans. But I don't know what his plan is for me. You know, that's a person who's focused on the third ingredient, not the husband, not the wife, but the marriage. You know, that's a great thing to focus on. It's a great thing to focus on, especially if you're a powerless human being. You know, it's a great thing to focus on. So, getting back to step two and four, you have resentment against God, so then, you've got a problem, you've got a challenge, you have a challenge, and, it's a problem. Put him on your fourth step resentment list, spell out the resentment, look and see what character defect is operating in you, just like any resentment against a person, you know. You have resentment against the person, you look at what my character defect is. So, I mean, if I'm talking to people who have no clue what the fourth step is all about, and they think it's just a cheshbon and nefesh, so then, and that's all it is, so then you don't know what the fourth step's about, that's okay. So study it if you want to, but, you know, I'm not speaking to people who are not addicts, not working the steps and stuff. I'm speaking now at this point, right now, to people who are working the steps. They're familiar with step four, and they understand that it's not putting myself down and blaming everything on myself, but it's just understanding the truth of what's going on over here. And, you know, look at the fourth column. I have a worksheet, but many others have. The AA Big Book has a simple worksheet, you know, with three columns. Really, it's four columns, just like the one I'm, you know, talking about. But anyhow, you know, open up the thing, and, you take your inventory, and you realize what character defects are operating here, why you hate God so much, why you're so angry at him, you know. What is your character defect that's operating over here? Accept it. How do you accept it? By sharing it with another. That's step five. You know, self-acceptance, self-honesty comes from sharing the truth about ourselves with another person. It doesn't come from thinking about it, you know? It's strange, but that's the way that it works. Self-honesty comes as a result of being honest with another. So that's what the fifth step is about. Accepting what you wrote in your fourth step. It's like Nasa Vinishma, which is obviously Nishma Vinasa Vinishma. Because otherwise, how do you know what to do? If you're going to do it, how do you know if you didn't hear first? You know, so it means you hear it, and then you do it, and then you're going to hear, which is how Chazal interpreted. Chazal say Nasa Vinishma means the mitzvah. Vinishma is the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. You know, the iyun. You know, not just knowing what the halacha is, but you know, depth of understanding in what his will is for us. So it's really nasa v'nishma, nishma v'nasa v'nishma. Same thing over here. The nishma is working the step. The nasa is to share it with another person, and then you're going to understand it properly and accept it fully. Okay, go through that process, and
and you'll see what the character defects are, and you'll be able to do a step six to decide if you're ready to surrender this character defect, because if you've been living with it for so long, it's obviously precious to me and you. Our character defects are precious to us. Not precious because we love being screwed up. No, we hate being screwed up, but we don't consider this being screwed up. Just like I don't consider my resentment at God being a horrible thing emotionally, only philosophically. Emotionally, I feel it. It's perfectly natural. I feel this way against him. I'm angry at him, you know, or I'm angry at my wife, or I'm angry at the guy in shul, or I'm angry at my boss, or I'm angry at the guy in traffic, or I'm angry at whoever. Like all the characters, like all the step four stuff, it's all, you know, resentment is always a problem, and it's always because I have a character defect of some kind, and that's the salvation from it, is recognizing that and being saved from, you know, being playing God and pretending like I hate him because he's a jerk. That's all, you know. So, so you know, you are evil. So anyway, you know, I'm not evil. I'm just messed up. And he sure as heck isn't evil, because I'm no one to judge who's evil and who's not evil. I can judge if he's chayav or putter or usher or mutter, but evil or not evil, I can't judge between tov and ra. So, you know, the Eitz HaDaas didn't get me that far. But anyway, so so getting back to the point and finishing up, obviously, because it's already time. The step seven can then, you know, God can then save me from my for myself, from my character, from my defect of character, you know, if I do a step six and I'm really ready to let it go, you know. If I don't, then he won't, but if I really am, then he will, you know. So resentment against God is like resentment against any other entity, you know. Just treat it like it's real, because God is real, and you can obviously be angry at him. And the interplay is revealed now in a new light between us and God, where he's not Superman here to save us, but rather the two of us in unison, me and him in partnership, create problems. Me and him in partnership create problems that I need his help to get saved from, and they further the relationship even more. That's what's really going on here. The interplay between God and me and my choices and his kaviyachol choices is he and I in a relationship called life, creating all kinds of challenges and issues and things that I might get resentful about. But it's just, the only thing that happened was me and him are working as partners and created this mess. Why? Well, it's to further our relationship. It's for me to depend on him even more and get closer to him even more, you know, by working these steps. Or maybe by doing other things, maybe by going to therapy, you know, or maybe by doing tshuva, you know, and on a very simple level, when it comes to mitzvahs and averis, I got to do tshuva for stuff all the time, you know. Just because you're an addict doesn't mean you don't have to do tshuva. For the addiction itself, tshuva's not going to help you. That's a joke. I mean, if you're an addict, you try it first, and if it works, great. But for an addict, tshuva does not work at all, because your problem isn't the aver. But for many other things, that's part of the partnership, is that it's a constant interplay, and tshuva is required, you know, coming back to God and apologizing and doing a step nine with him, you know, making amends is tshuva. That's making amends. Work steps 8, 9, and 10 with God is called doing tshuva. So I don't know if I answered the issue, but at the very least, for the caller who brought up the issue that it was bothering him and that he doesn't have a power greater than himself that can restore him to sanity now because he doesn't trust God because he has a resentment on him, well, guess what? I don't think that this is such a problem. I think that you're in a relationship with him, and that's the way things are in every relationship. That's the relationship itself. It's not a problem.
in my opinion. you know.
Dove?
Yes.
I didn't ask the question, but I found your response really helpful. And I
thank you.
I'm not sure if I identified totally with the caller at the time he asked the question, but at especially the latter part of your response about this notion of it being a relationship is, I think it's a powerful idea and potentially a powerful tool. I mean, I don't know if I'll, like you said, our screwed up things that we indulge ourselves in are precious to us, and we're busy doing them 24 hours a day, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 decades or more. So, I mean, I'm not sure if I'm how ready I am to use the tool, but I think, you know, it ain't easy to find tools to go up against something as powerful as the mess we've created instead of living a life. But that might be a shot.
Yes.
It might be an opportunity.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. I think as long as you face it in a humble fashion, you're going to be okay, you know? The problems come from... come when we don't face these things in a humble fashion, and instead we try to batter it with, you know, like a battering ram of self-will, you know. So as long as you're facing it the way you're facing it, it sounds, you know, mature, you know, humble, you know, to me, and that makes sense to me. You're not trying to, you know, it doesn't sound like you're poised to try to batter it with your self-will.
Depends on the moment.
Okay, hey, me too. So, you know. By the way,
and if you get used to a lifetime of battering, it's hard to get off that merry-go-round.
Yeah.
Even if you could see it philosophically and state it very well, it's a very powerful addiction.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, I mean, to me, the ichor so far hasn't been figuring any of these things out. The ichor for me so far has been behavior. In other words, putting this stuff in action is really deceptively simple. It's deceptively simple. When I feel a resentment against somebody, I pray for them. You know,
wow.
when I feel a resentment against somebody, I pray for them. When I feel a lust, you know, so I mean, well, the lust is a little bit different. I've explained before that the only time that it's appropriate for me to pray for someone I'm lusting after is either before I start lusting or after I first try surrender and, you know, letting it go. And if that doesn't work, then I pray for them. And then it's foolproof every single time when I pray for the person directly and explicitly and sincerely. If I'm sincerely praying for them, then the lust disappears 100% every single time. But I'm not talking about lusting praying. I'm talking about resentment. Praying for the person definitely works over time. If I can touch on the sincere praying for them, you know, then it's, you know, in your heart will know praying for them to stop this disgusting behavior and to stop being such jerks is obviously not praying for them. But, you know, we learn these things on our own, really. What does it mean to pray for the person? You know, and why would I do that? Why would I pray for somebody who I have resentment against if he's, you know, well, if he's doing something wrong? You know, but that's the way that it works. And, you know, Hashem asks for our prayers. You know, the Gemara in Baruchas is famous Gemara where the Kohen Gadol went in to the Kodesh HaKadoshim and he saw, and he had a vision of a certain Malach, you know, of Kesser, a certain Malach with the name that some people use nowadays, but I don't understand why. Very beautiful name. But anyway, so he saw the certain image of a certain, like a certain vision of a certain thing, you know, sitting on, you know, a kise, you know, and then Hashem spoke to him, and Hashem said to him, you know, I think it was Yishmael b'ni Barcheni, you know, give me a bracha, you know, daven for me, you know, give me a bracha. And he said, Yehi ratzon shi'yigol rachamecha al midasecha. This is Naigim Banecha Lefnim Mishur Sadin, I think is the Lashon of the Gemara, if I remember correctly. But the idea of Hashem, you know, davening for Hashem, we're not davening for Hashem, and, you know, obviously because he needs anything from us, you know, and the prayer that he says wasn't something like, oh, Hashem,
I hope you're okay, you know. He didn't say that, you know. He davened for what? He davened for the relationship that Hashem has with Klal Yisrael. He went for the third item there. And, you know, not me, not my wife, but our marriage. He went for the marriage, you know, he went for the relationship. And he said, okay, I'll daven for you. And then he davened for the relationship between Hashem and Klal Yisrael, you know. So if that's what I can do, so then, you know, it's going to take care of the resentment. But philosophizing about it won't help me. And you're right, there's too many, my feelings will fluctuate, and I'll feel okay one day, I'll feel hateful another day, I'll feel loving another day. That's not the point of it all. The point of it all is God, it really has to be my behavior. And I can daven whenever I want to. I can daven for the person even if I hate him, you know? I can say the right words even if I don't mean them. And I can daven and ask Hashem, let it be your will, please, that I mean these things one day. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing false about that. You know, in my opinion, and that's something that I can do all the time. That's something that doesn't. That's something I can always do. No matter where I'm holding emotionally, you know. I think that's the beauty in prayers, that your mouth you can control. You know what I'm saying? Your mouth, you know, you can speak out things. Your heart, not so easy. The Ramban says, "Beficha ubevavcha lasoso." It starts in the mouth and then it ends up in the heart, you know. Lasoso. And then you do it. That's not a foreign concept here. But anyway, hey, thanks for being on the call. Thanks for your feedback, too.
Thanks.
I'm going to sign off the, thank you. I'm going to sign off on the recorded portion here.